live from Chicago's Progressive Talk Studios on Milwaukee Avenue. This, The Ben Jarofsky Show. Today on the program, making his return, Mr. Bike, David Glowatz. And now your host, Chicago Reader columnist, Ben Jarofsky.
Hello, everybody. Ben Jarofsky here, WCPT 820. Dave Glowatz, as I said, independent journalist Dave Glowatz reports on local government at shygov.com. He's also Mr. Bike, a bicycling instructor and author of the best-selling paperback Urban Bikers Tricks and Tips. So I cannot let you escape this studio without asking you to weigh in on this. Did you read today's beloved Bright White Sun-Times? Did you read the essay that's titled By Governor Bruce Rauner?
I read the entire thing, and he made some good points, I thought.
All right, we'll get to those points. I have a hard time believing you actually believe that, but do you believe he wrote that? It says, by Governor Bruce Rauner. Do you think Bruce Rauner wrote this essay?
I believe that Bruce Rauner wrote that essay as much as I believe that Donald Trump writes all his tweets.
Ah, so do you believe that Donald Trump writes all his tweets?
They're both people with lots of resources. They have communications staffs. What do you think?
Wait, you answer the question. This is duck and dodge. You answer the
question. Don't you think it's likely that people at the top of units of government have communication staff to do the very thing, like write essays and write tweets for them?
This is one of my pet peeves. Well, first of all, the Trump thing, let's put that to the side. One of my pet peeves that I share all the time is when you have an essay in the paper and it's all about, we are finally going to get at the truth. I, your governor, or I, your mayor. This all started when Mayor Rahm was given an attribution for an essay in the New York Times on transportation, by the way. Do you remember that essay?
I do.
Okay. I, your governor, I, your mayor, I'm going to tell you exactly what I feel. And I start from the assumption, you're already starting with a falsehood. You didn't write it. So it should be by David Glowatz, press secretary, too. Then it's okay. Now we're dealing with the truth. So, yes. I do work from the assumption that Bruce Rauner did not write this essay.
Do you really believe that? Do you actually think that when someone on the communications staff pens an essay for the boss, that it should have their name instead
of
the boss's name?
Yeah, of course. And I'll go one step further. I don't believe Bruce Rauner read this essay. Do you think that? Do you think Bruce Rauner read this essay? Do you think he, like, reads all the essays? Do you think Donald Trump reads those tweets?
I think it's more likely that Rauner read his, that Trump reads all his communications.
Okay, I learned this a couple of weeks ago. I talked about this on the show, about Donald Trump and his tweets. There was a story, I think it was in the Boston Globe, about the assembly line at the White House preparing Donald Trump tweets. Did you see this story by any chance? There are people who work for the White House, probably English majors, as I like to point out. What a talk about a waste of an English degree.
Probably making good money.
Yeah, more money than you or I are making, that is for sure. And it's all public.
Consider the alternative. You can go into public relations instead,
Yeah, and they're publicly funded, by the way. And their job is to come out with these tweets. So, for instance, they've gotten so good at tweeting in Trump's style and his voice. This presumes, by the way, that Donald Trump ever wrote his tweets, even back when he was citizen.
We don't know.
We don't know.
We'll never know. Until he does his memoirs after he's
he'll
done
tweet
his
it. After he tweets his memoirs.
He won't write the memoirs either.
No. That's another thing. Do you think Bill Clinton wrote? Bill Clinton's got a novel out right now.
Well, at least he's got integrity to go on the book tour with the co-writer or the ghostwriter, whichever the case may be.
You talk about James Patterson.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, now so James Patterson is a famous novelist, wrote spy novels going back into the 80s. At some point in his career, he stopped writing them. It would be the James Patterson brand, and he would hire a writer to write a novel.
So the question is, did James Patterson hire a ghostwriter to be Bill Clinton's ghostwriter?
Oh, yeah. You could see that.
Like ghostwriter once removed.
Yeah. It's Bill Clinton and James Patterson, and neither wrote the thing, okay?
What a great gig.
But, by the way, unlike Bruce Rauner, if you go look at a James Patterson book, he'll give attribution to the person who actually did the writing. He'll be like, with research help by David Glowatz or whatever, something, you know. So anyway, I'm very curious, what did you find truthful about Governor Bruce Rauner's essay?
From a general good government standpoint, we have in Illinois government and a lot of municipal government entrenched players, incumbents who have been around for a long time, and there are lots of perils to democracy of very long incumbency. You're nodding your head. You agree.
Yeah. No, so I think
Rauner,
there are perils.
You know, Rauner brought that kind of thing up. And whether it's coming from Rauner or coming from Ben Jarofsky, I don't disagree with
that. There's perils to it. In fact, as we were just talking about this with Pat Quinn, do you believe in term limits?
I'm really on the fence with it. Every time I see some new article on it, I try to absorb it because there's been an awful lot of studying of term limits. Some studies reflect that where term limits are enacted, where there weren't term limits before, say in state legislatures or in state executive branches, the measures of better government don't indicate better government. One of the common criticisms of term limits, especially in state legislatures, is that state legislatures, there is a learning curve that requires a legislator to be there for a while to know the ropes. And if they do one term, they might not be as effective as they would be, say, in their third term. And then what some say happens when you have those people term limited out after, say, a couple terms, that you have the people who really know how to get things done in the legislature are the hired lobbyists, then who have a stronger voice instead of the constituency. And I don't know, but I mean, this is the argument.
That's the argument. So there's argument pro and con. I would say this to the point that I was in agreement with this, that there's a peril if you have people staying on too long, stagnation sets in, and too much power is consumed by too few people. I do not believe that Bruce Rauner really is against that in the abstract. I just think he wants the players who've been around for a while to be changed by people that he controls, and then they can sit in office.
Well, it's incumbent upon each of us who reads this kind of thing to take it in context and understand where it's coming from.
Yeah, where it's coming from. He doesn't mind if it's Republican guys sitting around for 400 years enacting laws that protect his interests. He just doesn't want Democrat guys sitting here. That's what it's all about. With me in the studio is Dave Glowatz, independent journalist Dave Glowatz, reports on local government at shygov.com. He's also Mr. Bike, a bicycling instructor and author of the best-selling paperback, Urban Bikers Tricks and Tips. He's also my partner in crime for the last 10 years or so on a series of podcasts. We were so far ahead of the time. We explored all kinds of municipal issues. And as such, Dave Glowatz is one of the few people in the world who understands Chicago's TIF program. I give him a lot of credit for that. And there's a TIF story in today's paper. I'm delighted by it. It has to do with the Congress Theater. Just get your thoughts on this. First of all, one of my favorite parts. I don't know if, did you see both newspapers today or just the Sun-Times?
I read the Sun-Times article. I haven't read the Trib article yet.
The Tribune has got like this interesting relationship with the TIF program. And I've said this to you many times. And they're not quite sure. They've not really embraced it as an issue. So sometimes they don't even like to mention the program that is funding the project.
They've often said that they don't want to use the words tax increment financing.
Yeah, because that would require an explanation. And, you know, every, I guess. I don't know why. But today, I think they were talked about. They did spell it out. And so they said tax increment financing. And then they
special wrote, taxing district.
And then they wrote comma, the so-called TIF program. Like,
they said so-called.
I don't know. I think it was something like that. Don't quote me.
So we don't need to tell your listeners what TIF means. Is that correct? Because on our podcast, I'm always careful to, when we introduce this concept, to be aware of new listeners.
I make no assumptions about anybody. There could be somebody driving through the Chicago area right now who has not had the fortune to read my years of columns on this program or hear our podcast. So the TIF program, of course, as Dave Glowatz could tell you, is a property tax surcharge that the city of Chicago slaps on property tax owners. They don't even know it's put on them, and the money is siphoned into a slush fund that's controlled by the mayor, hence the term slush fund.
And we should point out for purposes of this conversation about the Congress Theater that the state law that created tax increment financing districts intended it to spur development for blighted communities, communities that lacked economic development, where developers didn't want to build. So by skimming some of these property taxes would give those taxes to developers to kickstart development, therefore creating more development and then enlarging the tax base.
Very good. And for folks who aren't familiar with Chicago, the Congress Theater is on Milwaukee Avenue.
In the heart of Logan Square, which is, I don't have data around this, but I'm guessing it is the second most rapidly gentrifying area in Chicago. I think Fulton Market District has taken that over by a landslide.
Yeah, so this would be the definition of an area that is, quote unquote, not blighted.
Not requiring any economic incentives for developers. And I think my opinion and your opinion.
Many years ago, I would sit in the Community Development Commission is the governmental entity that oversees the distribution of TIF dollars. Effectively, they're the body that the mayor has to go to. I'm almost laughing at the thought of this, to seek approval.
It's the first level of approval in, what, three or four bodies?
Yeah, that rubber stamp at the assembly line. And so I can't recall them ever voting no to a mayoral proposal. And by the way, there's just a recommendation anyway. They're making a recommendation on the TIF expenditure, the creation of a TIF district to the city council.
To the finance committee takes it next, right?
Yeah, finance committee takes it next, and then it goes to the full city council. So it's just a recommendation. I can't recall them ever going against the recommendation of the mayor. So
I think it's more likely that if they see that it's not going to fly, they'll defer it. That's happened.
Yes. In fact, there was one, I got great delight in this. There's one TIF battle from many, many years ago. I think it had to do with the expenditure of money to build some kind of development on the far southeast side of Chicago. And there was a great deal of consternation. There was opposition from environmentalists who didn't want this development to go so close to Wolf Lake. I think that was the issue. It was an environmental issue. And so this meeting filled up with people, dissenters. And there was passionate debate on the matter. And I remember one of the commissioners in the Community Development Commission saying, "You should have worked this out before you came here." I'm like, "No, you're the body. You."
This is not the place for dissent.
Yeah, this is not the place. This is the place for rubber stamping. You're the body. I'm like, "No, it doesn't work." Well, I withheld the temptation.
A moment of candor.
I will now give the argument for giving money for this deal with the Congress Theater and see if you buy it, okay?
So let's provide a little background. The Congress Theater is a historic movie theater in the heart of Logan Square. If I'm not mistaken, it was one of the Bellaban and Katz chain, which is a chain of cinema throughout metropolitan United States.
When we were kids, almost all the movie theaters, many of the movie theaters in the Chicago area were B&K theaters.
Yeah. And it was repurposed as a concert venue when I was much younger, and rather popular concert venue. And then somewhere around the late 90s and the O's, the owners got into trouble with the city around underage drinking because they served booze there. They were letting some kids in who were not carded properly. There were some fights. There was one incident where a teenage woman was found wandering naked after she had just left. And eventually, reportedly, because of city pressure, the owner decided to close it down. And then it was bought a few years ago by, I think, an investment company.
Yeah, and that is the company that is seeking to redevelop it. And as part of a redevelopment plan, they are seeking TIF dollars. So they're seeking a subsidy from the city of Chicago, the taxpayers of the city of Chicago.
$9.6 million.
$9.6 million, yeah. Property tax dollars, once again, folks, that are siphoned off the property taxes that you think you're paying to the Board of Education. You think you're paying to the Park District. You think you're paying to the city of Chicago because you think that because your property tax bill tells you that's where you're paying it. But in fact, a certain portion of that gets siphoned off every year for the slush fund we call TIF, and every now and then that enables the mayor to dip into that slush fund as he sees fit. And in this case, he sees fit to spend $9.6 million redoing the Congress.
So we've been through this before with other projects. There is city documentation that's published by the Department of Planning and Development for every one of these projects that gives the city's justification for that incentive money, for that TIF subsidy. I'm guessing you haven't read it.
I have not read that yet. Okay, yes, that's a very good point. I have not read that. But I've read so many of them in the past that I can pretty much recite.
It's probably nothing new.
Nothing new. But I'm going to now play devil's advocate with you, young man. And I am going to argue that the justification for spending this money is the following. This is a big theater with historical value because, as you pointed out, its existence in the past life as a movie theater, it is an impressive-looking building. It's one of a kind for the area.
And it has historic designation. I'm not sure which of the bodies. But
is it,
I thought it was landmarked?
Is it preserved? Is it protected?
There are different classifications, and I'm not remembering which one it is. But it's got some blessing around history.
Okay. So as a result, the justification to spend the dollars is to keep a beautiful building worth preserving. Dave, if you were on the Community Development Commission, would you vote to recommend that the city appropriate $9.6 million for the Congress Theater's redevelopment?
An interesting question that I'd want the answer to is, given that there's historical value to this building, is there a way that the city could compel preservation by the developer of this building without giving the developer a subsidy? I don't know the answer to that.
I don't know the answer to either. By the way, I don't know if the city knows the answer to that one, but that is the override. I could argue that there's an overriding public interest in preserving this building that would warrant taking money from the slush fund to spend it on there. I just would need to see proof that, in fact, this project could not get done but for that handout.
And we should also mention that there's residences attached to the building, and 30% will be set aside for, quote, affordable, unquote, purposes.
So this one of the maybe one of the few TIF deals that actually is warranted. At the very least, it's reached the level of further study is needed, which some of them, like the one for Navy Pier, the $50 million, like, give me a break.
But at the same time, I'll just say quickly, the CDC approved a $10 million subsidy for a supermarket site in South Shore that's been vacant since the Dominick's closed over there.
Yeah.
So that's something that's arguably very much needed.
Yeah. No, that would be a textbook definition of what the program was intended for. It's 72nd and Jeffrey, I think
something
you're talking
like that,
about.
Yeah.
All right, let's get a caller in here. We got a bunch of people waiting to talk to Dave Glowatz and myself.
This call should be interesting. Let's see how this goes. Earlier we were talking about the Congress Theater. Well, on the phone, Alderman of the First Ward, where the Congress Theater is at. Friend of the Ben Jarofsky Show, Alderman Joe Moreno.
Is this really Alderman Joe Moreno?
Yes, it is.
Go ahead, Alderman. You're on the air.
Well, I just wanted to clear up. Thanks, Ben. The Congress Theater was a great deal, as your guest mentioned. You know, under the TIF ordinance, if TIF money is used, 20% is supposed to go to affordability. But we've seen in the city just recently on the Upper North Side where they've actually taken TIF money and then paid the city off for not doing it. And this situation, it's about a $50 million to save and salvage that beautiful property of private investment, that this money is going to help with that, of course. But we're doing actually closer to 35%. I made them push it above that affordability before I supported it. I think it's also of note, Ben, this is the Milwaukee corridor where we're on about our sixth transit-orientated development deal, where they all have 15 to 20% affordability on site. We do not allow them to buy out of it. And every single developer that came to me, Ben, whether they ended up building or they just had an idea, all of them said, I can't do this without TIF money. And I told them I made a pledge when I became alderman that I would give TIF money to only one of two things, back to our schools or affordable housing.
All right. Now, let me ask you this. First of all, this is your ward, the Congress?
Absolutely.
All right. Your name wasn't mentioned in the paper for some reason. All right.
That's okay.
There was no mention of the local alderman in the article that we were alluding to in the Sun-Times.
I testified at the CDC in support of it the other day.
All right, Joe, let me ask you this. As I said, this may be one of the few TIF deals that I could support because it seems saving the Congress Theater, saving an old valuable theater, is worth the public investment. In other words, there's an arguable public good that would warrant taking money that would otherwise go to the schools and using it on the Congress Theater. Are you convinced, Joe, that this meets the but-for standard that is so often overlooked in this city? In other words, but for that $9.6 million TIF handout, this deal would not get done.
I know it, Ben. I mean, we went through, this has been going on for 2 years. The stack of financing on this is 15 inches tall in terms of the loans, the private equity that's in that. They were promised, Ben, this is how long it's been. Under the old governor, they were promised $7 million through Senator Cullerton and others of state assistance. And they based their purchase and whatnot on that promise. That money never came because of the dysfunction of our state. So we didn't do, you know, we did a little bit more than that, but they were promised $7.8 million, a little bit around there, of state funding that never came about. And that's how they entered the deal on the good faith of the state of Illinois.
I see.
So I do believe that, but I also told them, you're not going to do the minimum 20%. You're obviously not going to buy out. You're going to push up to 35% for for the affordability on this site. And, of course, this is the same guy that redeveloped this before my time, but you remember the Bismarck?
Oh, yeah.
The Cadillac and Allegro Hotel?
Yeah, yeah.
The same local investor, developer, he's the same guy that redid that.
All right.
So these aren't guys coming out of New York, coming out of L.A., and, you know, many community meetings. And as I said at the beginning, I've never allocated TIF money for anything but our schools and affordable housing. So right near this site, Chase School got a brand new playground because of TIF money, and Diego School got a brand new playground because of TIF money. That's my pledge as alderman on how I use TIF money.
Alderman, can I ask a question? I've never looked closely at financing packages for developments of this type, but it just seems that in a neighborhood that is as hot as Logan Square in terms of building and,
sure,
and you know, desire by not only residents but businesses to locate there, why can't a developer make money without a subsidy?
I think one of the things that isn't talked about is one of the investors, an incredible guy, Sean, who was the partner of Riot Fest, who was also involved in the initial financing, unfortunately passed away suddenly at 42, 43 years old last year from a stroke. We lost a giant in the indie punk rock scene. And as a Chicagoan, and that also complicated this fiercely as well. If you look at the TIF deal, and I know Ben gets in the weeds on this more than anyone, the generation of what they're going to do on this side, because it's not a non-for-profit, will repay the TIF. I mean, we've got money in that TIF now, Ben, which is what I've told the Logan Square neighborhood, because of the TOD developments, where we have real money there now, where we can decide on green space for Logan Square, on continuing to invest in Chase and Goethe School, because there's real money in there when there really wasn't that much before some of these developments happened. So sort of a long answer to your question, but we've analyzed this. It's been going on for about 2.5 years. You know, it was the right thing to do. When I came in, the Congress Theater 7 years ago was the wild, wild west. We had drugs, we had gangs, we had rapes. We had to shut it down. It was terrible, even though it's a beautiful old gem that needs a lot of polishing. I just think this is the right way to do it because we're also providing much needed affordable housing. And as Ben knows, how I champion that in an area that needs it.
Yeah, the affordable housing. And thanks, ProCoach Joe. We're going to have to bring you on the show for the deep dive on this one. Thanks for calling in. I appreciate that. The affordable housing is sort of the most intriguing part of this deal because he's absolutely correct that the city is trying to figure out ways in gentrifying areas to preserve some affordable housing so that we just don't see a wholesale removal.
But sometimes what happens to satisfy these affordable housing requirements, you'll find developers, especially Logan Square, putting in like one bedrooms that doesn't allow families to live there, and it still forces out families.
It's always the devil is in the detail with the TIF. All right, D, let's get another caller in here.
Absolutely. We're going to go to Arlington Heights and talk with Gary.
Go ahead, Gary. You're on the air with Ben Jarofsky and Dave Gloetz.
Ben, with the Supreme Court's decision on caging, mm-hmm, we're looking at it one-dimensionally. You also have to look at it in light of interstate cross-check. Now, in Ohio, they found that 13% of the people did not return the cards,
mm-hmm,
but only 4% could be attributed to actual people moving. So you had a 9% reduction in the rolls from that mailing of a million pieces or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with interstate cross-check, all the states have been forced to turn over the voting rolls.
Mm-hmm.
They will now be able to not just target individual neighborhoods or races or zip codes. They'll be able to target the individual voter, because with a closed primary, you have to declare whether or not you're voting as a Democrat or a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
So all they have to do with the computers is pull up those voting rolls and send out the cards only to Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and you get a 9% reduction in Democratic votes.
So you're essentially saying this has become an effective tool to knock Democrats off the rolls.
And then some.
Mm-hmm.
This is a real conspiracy to take away our ability to vote.
Now, isn't it true that interstate cross-check is something that's voluntarily taken on by states? I think in Illinois,
the states have to turn over the publicly available rolls.
But don't they opt in to interstate cross-check? In other words,
they can opt out if they choose to, like we did in Illinois.
No, yeah. The ruling was that if it's publicly available information, they have to turn it over.
Now, I'm going to have to double-check on that one. I'm skeptical of that one, Gary. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. But because my recollection, it's been a while since we had this discussion, is that the state could opt out. That's what the activists were trying to put the pressure on the state of Illinois to do just that, to opt out of it.
But I don't think it did it?
I can't remember anymore.
I think it was close, but I think the State Board of Elections decided to stick with it.
We needed one of our callers to come in and help us. That's been so long since I had that discussion. I'm very suspicious, Dave, of the Supreme Court ruling in Ohio. I wonder what your thoughts are, just your instinctive thoughts on it, because it just seems like it's an opportunity for a Republican Secretary of State offices to just drop Democrats, with the potential Democrats, off the rolls and make it that much harder for Democrats to mount up the kind of get out the vote campaign that they need to take back some of these congressional seats and Senate seats. What's your thoughts?
We're going in the opposite direction of a national, we talked about this, you and I, recently, I think, a national voter registration program instead of one that's arguably balkanized state by state. Many other countries do this very successfully, where you essentially get voter registration similar to we get Social Security. You're registered as soon as you're born, and that sticks with you for life and sticks with you wherever you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would seem to me the way you would go if you want universal voting, and they haven't proved fraud. All right, I want to thank Mr. Pike for stopping in. Don't forget to check out his site, shygov.com.